You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM at the University of British Columbia Point Grey Campus in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Located on the traditional ancestral unceded territory of the Musqueam people. Welcome to the Lisa Lafferty Podcast, an exploration into the world of theater through a series of conversations with a talented and eclectic group of accomplished playwrights and theater artists from New York, Vancouver, Montreal, Toronto, London, England, and Saskatoon. Episode 5. Simon David of London, England, is a poet and playwright with a broad view of what is funky in the theater in London, England. Lisa Lafferty and Simon David.
Simon David, welcome.
Thank you very much.
I start with a simple question. What is it that you do and why?
Well, for the most part, I'm a poet, but half of my poems come out in the play form. So I'm writing poems all the time, but half of them, they develop into plays, and so I'm staging plays. The question and answer to why is, A, there's no choice. How I express myself is through poetry and theater, and it's a drive just to express all these things that I probably can't express in other ways.
You used to go to, is it Poets Corner in Hyde Park? Is that right? Do you still do that?
I don't do that so much anymore. That's something called Speaker's Corner rather than Poet's Corner. Poet's Corner is in Westminster Abbey. It's where all the dead poets are. So
right.
I have no great rush to get there, to tell you the truth. But there we are. I do quite a lot of performance around London, and I just had a show on that was called Wine Over Clementine, which was basically four seasons of a 21-year-old girl, all very poetic, played by an amazing actress called Emma Hemingford. But at the moment, I'm working on another play that's on in November called A Busy Bit of Mouth.
A Busy Bit of Mouth.
A Busy Bit of Mouth, yeah. I've only written the very first segment. I booked the studio space at a place called the Actor Center. How I work best is I literally usually do put a studio booking in front of me, and then I write a play to fill it. So I'm working on this piece, and I've got the first section written and memorized. And I intend to perform it one night by myself, and then I have an actress and a piano player who's going to perform it the second night.
So the Actor Center, did you call it?
Yeah, it's an actor centre in central London. It's basically a facility that has lots of workshops for actors, but they've got a main theatre there called the Tristan Base. I rent a little studio space there just because I need to try my work out. When I had Clementine on, I invited some agents and I invited different theatres, so it's ideal because you can fit 50, 60 people in there.
Oh, that sounds plenty. So tell me a little bit about what it takes to put on a play, to self-produce your own work there in London. Do you have to find a rehearsal space? Do the actors work for free at first? Are they equity actors that have agreement with their union to perform alternative pieces?
My last play, because it was a one-woman show, I basically had that on in the first half, and the second half was filled with all my poems that I had up to about 15, 20 different actresses performing in. And then I was just doing a profit share. So basically, I was just selling tickets for £10. The space is very economical to rent. And I literally, you know, paid each of the performers, the poets in the second half, probably paid them all about £40, £50, which is not a lot, but covered their incentives to sort of be a part of it. And ideally, you put these things on because you want to get a theater that's interested in them. So you invite producers, you invite other theaters, you hope to get a review or two. And we had a really good theater critic came and watched, a guy called Michael Billingdon, who's very famous in London. He came and watched the play and absolutely loved it and didn't write a review in the play paper, but he gave us an amazing endorsement, which really helped for us to try and attract other people.
Oh, that's great. So which other theater do you think would be interested in it?
Well, the theaters in London that do new writing are the Royal Court, Bush Theatre, Soho Theatre, a theatre called Theatre 503. So basically, because it's very, it's tricky with my work because my work is really high, pretty heightened language and very poetic. So a lot of the theaters are much more naturalistic. So in some ways, I had, when Michael Billingdon came, and also there was a literary manager came, and they were both like, oh my God, the play totally blew them away. But it definitely was, they're saying my work is unusual. It's very sort of, you know, it's a different language, and it's very sort of, not surreal, but it has an abstract quality to it. So a lot of theaters may not go for that, so I just have to keep on, you know, sort of plugging away with the work I create and hopefully get some sort of interest. They have a thing called the Fringe Theatre in Edinburgh, which I'm sure you're sure of. So I've had people say, do good in that environment, and that way you might get a little more attention.
The Edinburgh Fringe can be very expensive, though, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, getting any play on, I just happened this time around, I've been lucky because on a creative note, I seem to have written 2 one-person shows. So then the minute you have a smaller cast, you at least don't run the risks of high costs with hiring the actors. But yeah, it is definitely prohibitive. Edinburgh, there you have to deal with accommodation, deal with, you know, food and everything apart from just getting the plays on.
You have to pay for your venue, and there must be some sort of competition to get the venue.
Yeah, I mean, there's a place called the Pleasant Theatre that is based in London, and they put on quite a lot of different shows, and they have, there's a thing now called, like, Off the Fringe, so it's basically this sort of, it's sort of sub-fringe culture where it's people putting on plays that aren't necessarily in the specific, they're not actually in the program, but they're still doing theatre and still part of it. But yeah, it is definitely a thing where you do need some sort of finances just to get the basics done.
In Canadian fringes, you pay your base rate, you get the box office, the front of house, you get the venue, and all the marketing support by being in their general program. The Edinburgh Fringe paying for all the rest of that stuff seems like it would be very, very expensive, but obviously worth it because it's the hugest one in the world.
Yeah, well, I think people go there for the experience, but they also go with the hopes of getting their piece noticed and having an extended life somewhere else, be it in London or Scotland or wherever else, you know, is going to stage it. The good thing about Edinburgh is you can sort of, you know, you can be a little more risky creatively because you don't have to sort of fit any boxes, which you do in England, sorry, in London in some ways, you know, things are a little more cautious. And then just the whole festival feeling is, you know, people are up for the adventure. So audiences, they're willing to take on, you know, to see something that they might not see in their usual circumstances.
It's just a brilliant idea, the Fringe. Now, we're talking about the Fringe festivals, which we have all across Canada. Of course, our giant one is Edmonton, although the circuit is huge and all in all cities now. But the word Fringe in London really originated with the idea that a play wasn't West End. It wasn't a major production. It actually came about through censorship, the word Fringe. They were trying to censor people in the plays that they were doing in the 50s, and they just continued to do them anyway, even though some people were charged by the censor board. And then plays started to bust out in upstairs in pubs and stuff, and the whole fringe world began. What's the pub circuit like in London these days?
Yeah, there's so much work that goes on. And some fringe theatres, though, have developed a reputation where they're not so much fringy anymore. You know, this place called Theatre 503, for instance, it's a pub theatre, but they do lots and lots of new writing, and they have writing programs. So it's like, you know, there's certain things have got a little more sort of established. There's lots of theatre venues, but really at the end of the day, people are trying to get, you know, you can rent a theatre anywhere and, you know, put it on, but you want to be hopefully having a place that has some sort of good reputation for putting on good work. Otherwise, you're just going to be, you know, just doing friends and family and stuff like that. So ideally, there's a place called the Park Theatre as well, which is, it's very expensive to put on a show there because they know that they've got a building reputation. And they have like a program of sort of selecting work that, you know, that sort of fits their artistic merit, you know, that draws people into their program. But there's lots of other smaller fringe theatres. And it's also locational. If you pick a fringe theatre that's reasonably central, you stand a chance of, you know, getting people who are happy enough to take a bit of a gamble and come see your play. But there's some people who basically put plays out in the outskirts of London, doing the sort of further neighborhoods out. I mean, I never would do that personally. I mean, that's why I like the Actors Centre. It's right in the heart of London, and it's already a known venue and an establishment. So it actually already has a bit of a green light, where some people just, I don't see what the sense of putting a play on in some of the fringes that are just don't have either a reputation or that don't have any sort of locational value to attracting an audience.
Yeah, I remember as a student and even as a visitor to London, it's almost like there's so much going on in the theater at all times. For me, it was always like, oh, it's Tuesday and I'm available. I feel like going now. So I would end up in taking the tube to some dark, crawly place and getting some fish and chips and going in above a pub and seeing, you know, Uncle Vanya or something by some kooky group of people. So that's still alive and well.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, the thing is, London has, you know, because of its theater reputation in the West End, there's lots of people who are like, either they're tourists or there's some people, that's just the work they see. They see the main shows, and they see the musicals, and they see things that are actually, you know, already successful. Whereas, but there are lots of people who, in the theatre community in London, there's lots and lots of actors and writers and directors. So by the time you go support a few friends, that's another part of an audience, is people who are actually in the industry who like seeing work just expand and develop their own craft, but they're also supporting people they know who have created work. So, yeah, there's so much. I mean, but then London is a big city. It's like 6-7 million people. So, yeah, every night there's like hundreds of plays on, and some of them are plays that only have like, you know, 20 people in the audience, and some of them are full houses. And it's, you know, London has lots of art and other sort of creative endeavors, but it is really, really known for its theater. So that's, we're lucky that way, because there is lots of work being created, and there's an audience with an appetite to be seeing new work as well, which is helpful.
So one of the things I wanted to touch on my podcast, and you brought it up there, that let's talk about the West End and the trends that are happening in the West End these days. I mean, it's growing, isn't it? The more theaters are being qualified as West End theaters than 20 years ago, certainly. And what types of plays are going on in the West End these days?
Well, I mean, the West End is still predominantly, like, in the main theatres that are, you know, are all doing, like, you know, pretty well musicals, Les Mis, and, you know, the play called The Curious Innocent of the Dog has been on for ages. I mean, there's plays that just, once they get a footing in and they start developing an audience, then they just go on and on and on. But it is still, you know, sadly, predominantly musical-driven. Or else, like, the National Theatre is technically not West End, but it puts on lots of plays, but it has a little more experimental feel. But then, even then, there's plays that do well then that will transfer to the West End. But it is one of those things where, you know, they don't do it so much, but they also do rely on these Hollywood stars, and they'll use someone who's got a big name in England, and that actually will draw people into the audience as well. But I think the thing is, it's very, there's lots, you know, the West End and the theatre, I mean, there's like 100 theatres in the West End, so people are just sport for choice. But then there are lots of people who, you know, come specifically. There's tourism, you know, people will come and see, watch 5 or 6 plays in a week or two. They can satisfy their taste and their hungers quite easily.
Do you think the presence of Hollywood actors coming to the stage has impacted the types of plays?
I'm not sure if it's impacted the type of the types of play in some ways. I mean, yeah, they need to offer someone, you know, a Hollywood star is not going to come and do something that's going to be, you know, mediocre or substandard. They want something that's also, you know, that the play in its own self is going to draw people as well. Sometimes it is part of the framework of what happens here in London, is, you know, they throw a movie, you know, Nicole Kidman or whoever else. The second you've got a big name actor in there, it's like sold out.
Right.
So it works. So that's why there's incentive to do something like that, isn't there?
Yes. Is multiculturalism more present on stages?
Well, a little bit. At the moment, there's like a friend of mine just went and saw some Japanese drum company that, you know, they're just playing drums, but there's just because they're Japanese and it's got a sort of cultural sort of reference, so people that will do something. And then there was a bit of a stir with the, you know, and I think that came from the Oscars too, that, you know, so much of the writing was very white and middle class. So there are a lot of black actors and black theater makers who basically are trying to get their work a little more established and have a little bit more sort of a green light, just away from just the, you know, usual white stream, as it were. But it is still like, you know, there's lots of theaters where you go and you sit in the audience and there's 99% white.
Right.
So it's not just really the work that's on the stage, it's the people who are actually going to watch the plays. But there is another good fringe theater called the Arcola Theater, and they do a lot more sort of stuff for black audiences as well. But it's still, it's a bit of a struggle, I think, because, you know, and I think there's this element too that, you know, in order to get into acting school now, you need money. And in order to get, you know, even the acting schools are predominantly white as well. Not to say that different cultures don't have the money part, but it is, you know, it's very white driven. And unfortunately, the acting schools, but even the cost of going to see plays in the West End or even fringe theatres now is quite expensive. So it is prohibitive for some.
Well, that's a good point. So you mean the acting schools, you have to have money instead of skill just because of the economy?
Yeah. It's just, you know, it costs a lot to go to an acting school. So basically you do have, you know, there are people who are talented and, you know, they might get offered a place, but they might not be able to afford a place. So it's one of those things where, but there are people who, you know, it costs, you know, 11, 12, £1,000 to go to an acting school for a year, and there's lots of people who just cannot afford to get in that sort of debt. They want to be actors, but then they have to either take another route where they just, you know, get an agent or that route. You know, London is in a very expensive city. I'm not just talking about the theater, but just to live here is very costly. So it is one of those things, if you're a student, it's hard, and then there's school fees and things like that. I think about actors now basically are just coming from wealthy families because that's the only people who can afford to actually put them through drama school.
Have you had any experience with student productions, or do you know any students?
The last show that I did, because I had so many different people in it, I did actually have some acting students who were in my show, you know, but it wasn't the main play. The actress in Wine Over Clementine, actually, she's just auditioning for drama school. She's not in drama schools yet, but she's also not sure she wants to go into drama schools because she's got a good agent already. And then in the poetry part, because I had lots of different performers, there were some people, so I did actually have some like drama students in my show.
Okay, so playwriting. Where do new playwrights go to get their work done in London these days?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, lots of theatres, the main sort of new writing theatres again are the Bush Theatre, the Soho Theatre, the Royal Court Theatre, Theatre 503. They all have, like, writing programs now. So they sort of nurture their own writers. They'll have, like, either writing competitions, or they'll have, you know, they'll take unsolicited scripts. So anyone can send a script into the Royal Court, and it will be read somewhere along the line. But it is, you know, so much of it is now that they do sort of, they nurture their writers in some ways. So they don't just, you know, pluck out a play and just put it on, but they'll maybe, you know, pinpoint five or six different writers. And there's lots of opportunities for writers to get involved with various theatres. Like the Soho Theatre has, you know, ongoing workshops where you just literally, you can get into them by just submitting your work, and they like your voice, and they think, okay, they can work with you. And it's quite good too. It's not just for, once upon a time, it used to be more like just for young writers, so probably people under 25. But now there's lots of people starting writing in various, you know, different times and points in their life. So a lot of these workshops now aren't age restricted. But I also think too that lots of little theaters, they have this whole playwriting competition thing. There's a couple, you know, the Brentwood Prize, where they have the opportunity to put on this competition, and before they know it, you know, they've had like 500 people have sent plays in, and they pick one winner. But that enables theaters, though, just to look at other people's work, and you know, they get, you know, they can afford to be selected, though. There's so many writers out there. And again, like in relation to my own work is very poetic and very heightened. Not a lot of people write like I do that way. But there's a lot of, there's theaters that actually wouldn't go for that work because they prefer more like naturalistic, and you know, maybe that will change, but at the moment that's sort of an established sort of taste. But they do have lots of opportunity to help writers, but it's also a good thing for theaters because they get lots of people whose work they get to select, and you know, they can afford to be selected and just choose one or two pieces, but they get a great range to choose from.
Yes, I actually submitted a play to Theatre 503, I believe it was, and they sent me back the loveliest rejection, because I guess even though I was rejected, I was in the top, you know, 50 of the several hundred that they had received. So they were pretty proud of me, even though I wasn't going to get produced, but it did feel good. And also a theater like the Royal Court that, you know, accepts unsolicited scripts. There are only two theaters in all of Canada that will read your script unsolicited. So we got lots of gatekeepers here. That's just how tight the money is. So,
you know, it is tricky for theatres because it does take a lot of administration and a lot of time to read. You know, like the Royal Court probably gets, you know, 100 scripts a week, and they have to read them all. So they've got, you know, pools of different writers who are reading them, and then there might be one play in 1,000 that they can actually produce and put on. That's why they have this thing, though, too, where they set up like a writer's pool. So if they offer people workshops or offer them, you know, the opportunity to be part of a writer's program where they can come and do, you know, 12 weeks to develop a script, and that doesn't cost a lot of money. It's just like one tutor and works for the students, and they've got the space already. Yeah, we're lucky. There are lots of theaters now that do take unsolicited, but it also is starting to get a little tighter. And like, I've just spent energy trying to get a writing agent. They don't take unsolicited work. You know, they want to have a recommendation from someone in the theater, or as you say, the gatekeepers are, you know, fully occupied with their sort of task at hand of keeping, you know, the cream of the crop. And, you know, there probably are some good plays that probably just, even though they're good writers and good plays, they just don't get through that process.
Yes, I was a reader for one of the two Canadian companies that accept unsolicited scripts. And I figured it was about 1 in 10. For those other 9, I was the only reader. And that 1 in 10, I would recommend to go to workshop, or it could be produced in one of their venues. And then after 10 years, over 100 plays I read, and only one of them was ever produced. So it is a huge task to accept unsolicited plays. And I don't know how many other readers they had, but, you know, 100 scripts a week is that's a lot of readers. It can take a long time. We've submitted reports as well. So,
yeah, no, I mean, there's some theaters that do reports, but for most of them, they just can't. You know, they just don't have that manpower, so, or woman power, or person power. So they just end up having, you know, they'll read the script, and if it's the script they want, they'll take it on board. But most of them are just rejection letters, because that's all they can actually, you know, do. And, you know, probably 10 years ago, it wasn't like that. Probably 10 years ago, well, I know I was sending scripts off to the Bush Theater, and you'd get a written report, which is really helpful, because it was actually, you know, it's only someone's subjective view, but it still, you know, would either give you incentive to fix something up or give you a little bit of guidance on which direction to go.
I just wanted to ask, because it's part of my mandate of my podcast here, about women playwrights. Of course, London is responsible for Carol Churchill and Sarah Kane. And what, who's the hot woman playwright these days?
Well, there's Lucy Kirkwood is a set of play on at the Royal Court called The Children, and she's a really, really good writer. And there's also Polly Spennan, who wrote That Face, is still putting plays out. She wrote this play called That Face a number of years ago as a 19-year-old girl, and that sort of carried, you know, that's put her on the map. And there's another writer called Anna Jordan. She wrote a play called Yen, which is, you know, like the Royal Court, for instance, I think just did a whole season where pretty well all the writers were female.
Oh, cool.
And there are, you know, there's Laura Wade, who wrote a play called Posh, and Lucy Prebble, who did a play called Enron. I mean, there are lots now where there are female writers who are getting their work produced. And, you know, there's a lot of female artistic directors now, so that has changed. You know, once upon a time, we've got male artistic directors and predominantly male playwrights, with a, you know, sprinkling of female playwrights in there. But I think that's something that's just totally, you know, that has altered big time, partly because of the artistic directors in charge of theaters, but it's also, you know, there's lots of women writers out there now, so there's lots of them writing really good work.
It's sort of par for the course. It's not so much an issue.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's so much an issue. I think a few years ago it would have been, but I think now it's just like, you know, and hopefully it's your play and the work that goes on merit. And I also think that this, you know, because theaters now do, or a lot of the new writing theaters do these workshops that encourage and develop new work. So there are, you know, they accept a lot of female writers into that. So that allows the writers to develop and have some encouragement. And I don't think writers now, you know, whether it's a gay playwright or a black playwright, I think it's just the play that holds its own. I don't think it's really the identity of who's wrote it is such a big issue.
Now, I was there about 5 years ago, I think, and you and I went to see a play called Pests. Was that a female playwright?
That was a woman called Vivian Fransman. And she's done a lot of work for a theater company called Clean Break, which basically works with women who are coming through the prison system. So Pests, I absolutely loved. I watched it about 5 or 6 times, and you and I watched it together, I believe.
Yeah, we watched it, and I sat there with my gut completely tense the whole time. And then at the end, a tear literally went from my eyeball and tinked off the inside of my glasses, like a tear shot out of my eye in the last moment of that play. Wow, that was powerful stuff, eh?
It was powerful. And I mean, what was nice about that play, too, was because she had such interesting use of language, and the two actors in that just absolutely, you know, nailed the language so well. So that was definitely a potent one.
Yeah. And I think you made the point, too, at the time I took the script home with me, that it's almost unreadable, the language, because it's so, but the way they brought it to life, you know, it's not like I could necessarily reproduce it. The accents were so thick, the language, I think it would be hard to do that play in Canada.
Well, yeah, I think that play particularly is because the way they're using the language is almost like patois, like Jamaican, but for white actors, not, you know, Caribbean. And there were lots of people, I've heard other people who have read that and just don't get it. The one actress, Sinead Matthews, who played the one character, Pink, I mean, she's a good actress anyways, but she loved doing that language, and you could just tell that that's, you know, that play was so language-driven. But no, it probably would not work in Canada, because if you put a Canadian and North American accent to that, it would just like dilute it. I mean, that worked because it had that English, so it was almost, but it was saying that it was almost its own language, so, you know, it might come across, but it was just very, it did seem very suited to this part of the world.
It really was almost its own language, kind of like what you're getting at with your own poetic language, the way you mix around words and stuff. It makes sense to us, but nobody else is saying it that way. It's kind of Shakespearean, really.
Yeah, no, I get that a lot with my work. I mean, I get lots of people, and I don't, you know, say it vainly, but I get lots of comparisons on my stuff to Shakespearean because it's just, A, it's highly heightened and poetic, but it's just a very sort of unusual language, but it's very dense, and some people don't get it. Well, they do get it eventually, but when I auditioned for Wine Over Clementine, I had two actresses, one from a very good background, really good agent. She said, look, I can't memorize this stuff. And then Emma Hemingford, who was in my play, was so amazing. She, like, memorized it in 5 seconds. And the play, A Busy Bit of Mouth, I'm writing at the moment, I'm writing and memorizing as I'm going along. So I actually get it because it's, you know, my own language. But, you know, people who come see my plays, they definitely do get blown away by the language. But sometimes, too, it is a bit too intense for people. It's a lot of work. And same with Shakespeare. It's not an easy little go to sit
down good.
And digest it all.
Good. I'm glad it's a lot of work. What else are we doing? We're sitting there watching you being entertained. I think work is good in the theater. How, as a playwright, how does one make a living in theater?
Yeah, well, I mean, you basically have to be successful. In order to be making money, you need to start getting commissions from theaters. And so you need to get one play on that's going to have some, that puts you on the map. And so, and also get an agent. Right now, I've got my script out with a few agents and things like that. And, you know, lots of writers still have to rely on other secondary jobs. It's really not till you actually have some sort of success that you can actually start making money, because that's what opens up the commissions. And also, too, there's some, like, Simon Stevens is a really well-known theater writer here in England. He's had this curious incident of a dog on in the West End that's basically probably made him a fortune, because he's had a play that's drawn in the big crowd and has had a West End audience. Whereas there's probably lots of other writers, too, they probably have to rely on teaching. Some of them are directors, and it's not an easy thing, but you do, you know, in some ways what you have to do, you just have to keep on writing and getting work out there and work on that's actually going to make you successful, because it's not actually till you start getting some sort of commercial success that you can actually build on. Otherwise, there's probably lots of writers who don't make money.
True enough. Okay, I have a couple of fun questions to end it out, since you were Canadian for a while. When was the last time?
For a while.
when was the last time you swam in a lake?
The last time I swam in a lake, well, it would have been in, I was going to say it was going to be in Canada, but I probably swam in a lake here. Oh, yeah, I go down to Wales sometimes and spend time on this farm with Amy Bell, who I used to hang around with a little bit, and she had, like, a little lake in the woods, so that's the last time I swam in a lake.
Have you ever seen a bear?
Have I ever seen a bear? I've seen Paddington Bear lots. Does that count?
Down at the station?
Yeah.
Well, Simon, it has been a great pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you so much for joining me. And but you all success. And can you just say, I forget, Wine Over Clementine, I have no problem with. A little bit of mouth.
Yeah, a busy bit of mouth.
A busy bit of mouth. I love the idea as a writer of setting yourself a deadline. I mean, it just totally works for me as well. You set a deadline and then you have to fill the spot. It makes a lot of sense. I do enjoy that.
No, it's a great one, but some people don't. I mean, I'm having fun with this one. I've already got the flyers made for Busy Bit of Mouth, and I don't even have the play. I've just got the flyers and the venue. So now I've got the first section done, and, you know, one just creates a way. But I think that's the good thing about it. Otherwise, you just don't get work on it.
Even in that system, do you know what A Busy Bit of Mouth is about before you start writing?
No idea. I mean, I always write off titles, so I literally have... No, I have no idea, but that's where my writing comes from. I write just totally... I love writing off titles. But eventually, I've got this little phrase that it's like, you know, it's A Busy Bit of Mouth, but, you know, one will talk. You know, you talk enough, you'll hang yourself enough, or whatever the expression is.
I like it.
So yeah, I have no idea what it's about, but I will, on November 24th and 25th, by the grace of God, I will have a play on.
And you'll know what it's about by then.
Well, hopefully.
Well, thanks again, Simon, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Okay, it's been a real pleasure, Lisa. I appreciate every little cell in your brain.
Thank you for listening to the Lisa Lafferty Podcast. This was Episode 5. To download other conversations in this series with Brad Fraser, Allison Kelly, David J. Diamond, Laurel Thompson, and Yvette Nolan, go to citr.ca.